Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit our website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Today, Aina asks, what's happened to all of the specimens from Dublin's Dead Zoo, the Natural History Museum?
Paula, what I want to know is, where are you putting the stuff? If you had to take the window out to get the skull of the whale out, where did you put it? Where's all this stuff going?
We meet the man who's been crowned King of the Frogs in Baltimore, West Cork.
So I was christened the Frog King about 6 years ago when the first one started school and she told him about the frog spawn.
And we hear from the scientist who wants to know if animals get bored.
In the last few years, I've been working on the idea of animal boredom, because so far that's mainly been studied by psychologists and using lots of questionnaires to ask humans questions, but it hasn't really been studied as a biological phenomenon before. And it's a really important animal welfare issue, actually quite important for humans as well, to understand why we get bored, why it causes the problems it does, and why it's so horrible for us. We need to know whether it's also horrible for animals.
So, as always, a very busy programme ahead of us on Mooney Goes Wild this evening. Let's talk to our panel. Aina Nealana, who I believe is ensconced in Dublin this week. You've left County Clare, Aina. Did they kick you out?
No. I had a medical appointment. I had to get my annual motor checkup on myself, so I'm having it this week. So they didn't kick me out. But I'm amazed now when I come up how retarded Dublin is compared to West Clare.
Excuse I, what do you mean?
From a point of view of spring, Derek, in West Clare we have flowers, we have celandines, we have winter heliotropes, we have all of these in flower, whereas up in Dublin everything is tight and reluctant, a few Shiverton snowdrops is all I can see up here. And it's amazing, from one side of the country to the other, west to east and further south to further north, it's, I'd say, a fortnight behind in Dublin. So they are retarded by 2 weeks compared to the surroundings in Clare.
Well, Richard, you're originally from that part of the world, you're from County Limerick. Would you agree? Over the years, have you noticed this kind of lagging?
No, I can't say I have really, but I must say this time of year is very special where I am because I'm right beside the sea. And as you all know, there's been a whole series of storms. The water comes rushing in, huge waves and winds and everything. And the effect is to deposit countless thousands of creatures dead on the beach. The gulls are cleaning up for mainly razor clams and cockles, mussels and things, and various other things as well. But what is interesting, and I wonder if Anna has any theory on this, these are long-lived creatures. The razor clam will last for over 20 years, and it can burrow down about a metre very quickly in adversity. They must have endured dozens of storms in their lifetime. How is it that they have become victims so easily?
Yeah, this happens when you have easterly winds and easterly storms. It's well recorded on the East Coast. Great quantities of things being washed in. And I suppose the razor clams have to feed. I mean, they burrow away down naturally because when the tide is out and we're digging for them on the low shore, they're away. But I mean, if they live further out under the sea, well, then they'll have to come up and feed. And if there's storms going all the time, they get scooped up and brought in on the currents. So unless they're going to fast and abstain for a fortnight without coming up at all, they'll be caught when they come up. They have to come up. The same with the cockles. They're burrowed down and we see them on the lower shores and they're burrowing away. I mean, I used to see them when I was diving and you would be under the water and you'd see the things sticking up, which was great because once the water went away, they vanished into the tide. So I'd imagine they just got caught out for their dinner and the waves and the storms and the currents brought them in, and it's to the advantage of the seabirds.
Well, now, Aina, that doesn't seem to be a totally satisfactory explanation because the storm only lasts in a couple of hours overnight. You have a big storm. Surely creatures as ancient as these in this environment for so long would have learned and adapted ways of suspending their dinners and going without the dinner for the day or something. It's hard to believe that they starve and come to the surface. The storms are not that prolonged, and things like giant ragworms. They're marvellous things, a third of a metre long. My grandchildren love to see these things. They get torn up out of the mud and flung up onto the shoreline. It is weird. It's just a contradiction.
Yeah, Richard, what seems to be happening is that the storms are not just upsetting the water, but they're gouging up the seabed itself. So the whole seabed where those worms are, where the razor shells are, where the cockles are, in the actual mud itself, is so ploughed up by the storms that the things are all hauled up and drowned and die, and then they get washed in subsequently by the currents coming in. So it's more obviously than just the water being affected by the storms, it's the actual seabed itself which causes the damage to the seabed that causes the death of all of these things.
Thank you, Aina. Now listen to this sound. Do you know what it is? Come on now, I'm sure we've all heard it over the years. Have you got a little pond in your garden? Do you have frogs gathering around your pond at this time of the year? Which side of the country are you on? Are you on the east coast, the west coast? Are you north? Are you south? When do you normally see the frogs in your area? Well, this is the time of year that frogs come out of hibernation and emerge into spring with one priority, to breed. And when it comes to breeding, frogs have to be in the water. So, if you're in the right place at the right time, at this time of year you might see the dramatic movement of large numbers of frogs heading for a body of water. And when they get there, this is the kind of sound you'll hear. Richard O'Flynn is owner of the Yellow Door Gallery and Gift Store in Baltimore and County Cork. Most of the artwork he sells is inspired by nature, and he's a nature lover himself, which is just as well, because over the past few weeks he has witnessed a literal invasion of frogs in the pond in his garden. We're going to speak with him now. Hello, Richard, how are you today? Tell us what's going on.
Well, it started the month on St. Bridget's Day. They came in their thousands, marching across the garden and across the driveway into their little pond that we have. Well, little I say, but it's the size of a tennis court, into the pond. And they spend sort of 2 or 3 days there mating and upsetting all the kids and keeping them all out running around the garden late at night, trying to find them, having loads of fun with them. But it gets quite loud for a couple of days, as you can imagine. The pond has a decking on the edge of it, which is attached to the house, which is just under the window of our bedrooms. So their croaking for 2 or 3 days isn't the best, taking the best in our house.
So you're talking about the frogs coming out of hibernation, and what's coming to your pond then are presumably the first lot. So you've had nothing hibernating in the pond as such. All of these frogs are approaching your pond. Is that what you're telling us?
Exactly, exactly. Now, there's some of them in the area over the year that you'll see around the garden every now and then. But like you're talking, maybe seeing one or two a week here and there in adult form. Whereas all of a sudden, every year, they just come in thousands because we're on the side of a hill. And so there's no farmers in the area. It's a West Cork hill, so it's all rock and gorse bushes and that sort of area. So it's not the only thing that farms that are horses feeding off of it. And it would be quite boggy then between the rock areas and between the hills. So they probably live out in the bogs and just come to the pond for spawning time.
Yeah, frogs hibernate, and what happens is they have to go back to the pond in which they were born in order to spawn. And as a frog lives for 12 years, if it's left untouched, you're going to have 12 years lots of frogs coming back to your pond. So the males hibernate separately from the females, and the first lot to come back are the males, and that's what you're having first. They come along first, set up territory, croak like mad, and then the ladies then, who are hibernating separately and quite modestly, are coming then to meet the gentlemen at the pond, and then they mate with each other, they lay the spawn, and then all the frogs go away, back out to catch flies and live, because they don't need to be in a pond the whole year. They only need to be there to spawn. They don't need to be there otherwise, because they have lungs. They're not mating the whole year round. They're not humans. They only mate at the mating season, and it's early because you're down in West Cork where it starts. You're having them coming out of hibernation early, and you're having the mating season of the frogs. It's absolutely great. You should be delighted with it instead of giving out about the noise.
Oh God, we have a ball. We love it. Locally in the local school, I have 3 kids under 11, all girls. So I was christened the Frog King about 6 years ago when the first one started school, and she told them about the frog spawn. And of course, they hadn't seen frog spawn in ages in the school, so I took them in because I still think you're allowed to take them into the local school so they can watch them developing from spawn to frogs. And so I became the Frog King for years until my daughter this year took over and became the Frog Queen. She does it now because she's old enough. But the numbers are just huge now because this is a pond that we made in a boggy area where there was no even water in it before. And used to, when I landed on the site first, the only thing they used to see was where the horse puffs used to leave a print in the ground in the boggy area would fill with water, and then a frog would come and spawn it. They were looking for any bit of water at all. So when we were building the house, we dug the area out a small bit, and of course the following year it filled with water because it's full of springs. So the frogs came back, and they're just getting bigger and bigger and more of them every year.
Richard, you have created a frog city down there. You mentioned how stony and barren the place was, and that, I think, is the answer to the question. You have, in fact, put up a pond that is the only place where frogs can really get together and spawn every year. And it is an extraordinary resource, and I wish more people would do it. Now, frogs are amphibians, and worldwide, the greatest large group of animals that's in trouble are the amphibians. Now, our ones are not, it seems. The Irish Peatland Conservation Council carried out various surveys, and the thing is healthy enough, it seems. But internationally, of all the species of amphibian in the world, one prediction says that the half will be extinct in 40 years. So we have to cherish our frogs. Hope that the thing called the chytrid fungus, which affects them, won't get into us here in Ireland.
The frogs in West Cork and Kerry are a different clan to the frogs we have on the eastern side of Ireland. They did genetic studies on those. The eastern half of Ireland have frogs that have descended from ones introduced to Trinity College way back in the early 1600s, but the ones in the west of Ireland are a different clan, and they reckon they have been there for a very long time. So it's great that you're doing this. Frogs have very few enemies because they taste horrible, but I'm sure you do have herons and birds like that that will feed on frogs. Do you get an influx of those into your garden when the frogs are beginning to disperse?
We do, yeah, we do all the time. The herons are well alive on the Island River. You can't go 100 feet without finding a heron on the Island River. And the island is about maybe a mile from us. So, yeah, we have a heron every day that calls in for lunch and calls in for dinner and heads off again. But sure, it's part of nature. If there was only 10 or 12 of them, I'd protect them more. But we just leave them off. There's otters. We had an otter came and cleaned out. The pond used to be a Japanese koi pond. I put 5 Japanese koi in it when I dug it first, when there was no frogs there at all, and they turned from 5 to 500 in about 5 years, up to 2.6 long. Huge fish. And one otter came up the stream, smelt them the whole way up, came up when they were hibernating at the end of the pond, and bit the gills out of all of them, killed them all in one winter. That was the end of that, and then the frogs took over. So it's been a nice balance, but nature's nature. You'll always have some things picking on others one way or another. It has to be balanced some way, doesn't it?
Indeed it does. Richard, thank you very much indeed for talking to us today. We really do appreciate it. And keep looking after your frogs. The king of the frogs. That's Richard O'Flynn.
Thanks very much, Derek.
Now let's continue this conversation as we say hello to Collie Ennis, who's a research associate in the Department of Zoology in Trinity College in Dublin. He's been studying frogs and newts since he was knee-high to, a frog or a newt. Anyway, hello, Collie, how are you today?
I'm good, Derek, and yourself?
I'm great, Collie, thank you. Now, Aina, earlier you made a reference to the fact that frogs on the East Coast are different to frogs on the West Coast, and there's a connection to Trinity College in Dublin. Can you explain, please?
Yes, indeed. There was this thing about the fact that there was no Irish name for a frog. The Irish for frog was frog. And even in Patrick Pearse's time, they were concerned about this. And when Trinity College was founded at the end of the 1500s, a fellow called Gwithers was conducting the lectures to the biology students. And as there were no frogs in Ireland, he brought over frogs from Oxford and Cambridge, where the alma mater of Trinity was. And the students there studied the frogs, chopped them up, did what they did, and threw out what was left over into the ditches around Trinity College. And the story was that all our Irish frogs were descended from these Trinity graduates and are so very posh. And this was always the saga, and this explained why there was no Irish word for frog, because they weren't around. But then, when they got doing genetic analysis of things, they discovered, and I was reading about it in the Biogeographical magazine, that there were in fact two clades, what they called clades of frogs, that there was a West of Ireland clade of frogs, which was different to the East one. The one on the eastern half of Ireland did indeed relate very closely to ones in Britain, but the ones on the West Coast didn't, which would seem to give the lie to the fact that all our frogs came over to Trinity College. And I'm just wondering, Collie, I mean, what's the actual science and all of this, or is it all an old wives' tale?
Yeah, a bit of both, really. I suppose the genetic evidence is fairly clear that there was a population that survived the ice age down in the corner of Kerry, in the corner of the country, and then made their way across. And of course, there is a possibility that there was animals brought in from the UK and maybe from Europe as well. That was the tale, that they were brought in and released into the ditches around Trinity before it was drained and the Liffey was walled in, and that's where they spread throughout the country. But again, genetic evidence would seem to tell a different story.
Collie, do you really believe that frogs and toads and so on could survive? I mean, the stories of the Ice Age are that the ice was kilometres high and extended down beyond the south coast of Ireland. Refugia in that, it boggles belief that anything could really have made it through that. Couldn't the frogs have been brought in by Neolithic people or Bronze Age people? And the great navigation way back in those days was the sea, and they could easily have got in there. So this would explain why there are two genetic varieties there, or would it?
To answer your first point, with the large ice sheets, there was a severe drop in the depth of the sea around the country, and there would have been land connections not only to the UK, but also to Europe. So the areas around those big icebergs that covered, and those big glaciers that covered the landmass, the areas around them would have still had spots where these animals could, in theory, have survived quite well. I mean, there are populations of the common frog, as we call it, or the grass frog, as it's called in Europe, that breed in, you know, the Alps, very high up in mountains, and you can see them even spawning in puddles that are surrounded by ice. I checked my own pond last night to see if there was anybody moving, and I found a pair in Amplexus under the ice. So they, Amplexus is their breeding phase, where the male grabs the female from behind with his strong arms. And as I said, they were under the ice in that position and raring to go. So they're very, very adaptable little creatures. And it wouldn't surprise me if they could have made it through that severe phase of the Ice Age. And as you said, also being introduced by humans.
It seems to me this notion of frogs moving, they're not great. You don't associate them with covering great distances. And indeed, the West of Ireland and the East of Ireland haven't led to some kind of hybrid between the two, have they? Richard O'Flynn's frog pool, what would be the catchment of his frog pool? How far away would the frogs come to spawn? And do they move a lot?
They do. They have a very wide range. You can get frogs that will move up to 10, 15 kilometres away from a pond. Some are more adventurous than others, obviously. You tend to get females that will wander further away. Males like to stick around their ponds that they themselves were spawned in and grew up in, and they become attached to a certain waterway in many ways. So they will come back there to breed every year. There are always more adventurous individuals within a population, and they're the ones that will find other areas to breed, spawn there, and due to the large number of spawn, that creates opportunities for them to move on. So they can actually march quite quickly across an area where they haven't been established before.
Yes, and of course there are so many of them. I mean, there's huge amounts of frog spawn, and if they have enough space in the pond and enough food, they can survive. It's only tadpoles that you have in tanks that you're studying in school that are cannibals and eat each other. But the thing about the frogs that's curious, I find very interesting at this time of the year, Richard O'Flynn down in West Cork had his frogs up and at it on St. Bridget's Day, Loy Le Vige, the first day of spring. And yet, here you are a fortnight later, Valentine's Day practically, and you have your frogs under the ice in your pond, and you're only in Dublin, I presume. So, you know, the way the spring moves across the country is reflected in how the leaves come on the trees, but before that, it's reflected in the ponds and the frogs. And the very last place that we will get frogs in will be in Cavan and Monaghan, because they're the coldest parts of Ireland, and it could be the end of March, well after Patrick's Day, before there are any frogs at all out of hibernation there. So they're very much dependent on the temperature of the surroundings, because it's the temperature drop that makes them hibernate, and then the rise in the temperature that makes them wake up again.
Yeah, you're looking for that magic 4 to 5 degrees in the water that really gets them kicked off. That's the usual thing. But as I said, they're quite adaptable, and if they live in a colder area of the world, they will breed readily at lower temperatures. The place in Ireland that we usually see the spawn earliest is Cork. So we will get records of spawn nearly every December or early January down there, which is fantastic to see. And as you said, it creeps across the country then. You see them spawning in different areas. Yeah, it's a great sign that spring is on the way, and great for everybody to kind of get out and have a look at them. It's important, though, to remember that they are a protected species, though. And as much as we'd like to relive our youth and take them home in jars to look at the metamorphosis from spawn into tadpole into frog, it's not really advisable, because if we were all to do that at the same time in a local pond or a local area, there'd be no spawn, and that would basically wipe out a generation of frogs, which isn't a good idea at all. While there are still big populations of frogs around, the urban frogs are drastically declining, especially in areas like Dublin, Cork and Galway, because habitat fragmentation and pollution are having massive effects on them, and it's very difficult for populations to hang on in these areas where they don't have genetic diversity, because there's no new individuals coming in and there's a lot of pollution that affects the ponds that they're living in.
Colin, we must be clear, you know, there's actually no, we have a derogation against that Habitats Directive, and you, we are allowed to study frogs for educational purposes and put them back. And in fact, knowing about how they work would encourage people more to maybe have a pond, to maybe make sure that the area where they have, not be cutting the grass every moment to allow cover for them, that they would make in urban areas places better suited for them, particularly now when we're all within 5 kilometres of our houses and people are more aware of the surroundings around them. They can certainly make an effort to make their gardens and people that have big spaces more friendly for frogs, and being aware of them is a way of doing this.
Yeah, I mean, it's important that teachers realise they are 100% allowed to take frogs spawn away to let develop in the class, and that's how I got my love of amphibians and reptiles, was looking at frog spawn developing. And as soon as it starts to get its front and back legs, the tadpoles can be returned to the area where they were collected in, no problem. It's perfectly legal for that to happen. What we just don't want to happen is people to take them away en masse from a particular breeding pond.
Colly, thank you very much indeed. Very nice talking to you today. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Derek. I hope that helped. All right, see you later, man.
There goes Colly Ennis, back to his research in Trinity College in Dublin now. I received an email last week from a colleague of mine who works in Lyric FM. Her name is Gail Henry. And she said, "Hi, Derek, just thought I would send you on this little video collage of the selection of birdlife in my Limerick city garden. It's just amazing how lockdown has made us all more in tune with nature and the incredible array of birds around us. Up to recently, I would not have been able to identify one bird from another with confidence, nor would I have realised the array of activity right outside my back door. Anyhow, in order to further examined things, I started taking pictures just after Christmas to document the bird life in my Limerick garden, and have been guided by Eric Dempsey and Michael O'Cleary's The Complete Guide to Ireland's Birds, which I got as a Christmas present, and a terrific book it is too. Each time I take time out to feed, watch or listen to the birds, I call it my nature therapy during lockdown. Attached is a video collage of some of the bird life I was able to capture. If you feel it can be used on your digital platforms or shared, please feel free to use, which is exactly what we've done. So if you go to rte.ie/Mooney after this programme, you'll be able to see all the lovely birds that are visiting Gail's garden. But we thought we can't just read out an email and put her video online without having a chat with her. So earlier we asked our resident ornithologist Niall Hatch if he would have a chat with Gail about the activity in and around her garden in Limerick City.
Well, Niall, the reason I sent in the video was in January, I decided to capture the array of bird life that was coming into my garden. And I was quite surprised, actually, at the just extensive amount of birds that were coming in and out, and the diversity and the colours and the nuances of so many different species. So I created a collage, added some music, and sent it off to friends, family, just to say I'm here and hi, and give them some cheer. And it was a kaleidoscope of colour and beauty that really up to now I hadn't particularly observed or really didn't look critically at what was coming in and out of my garden.
And Gail, how many different species of birds have you noted so far in the garden, and what have you been doing to attract so many of them in?
Well, up to now, I've counted 22 different types of birds, two of which, for instance, like sparrowhawk and long-tailed tit, only visited once. But I have a peanut feeder, and many of the birds were coming around eating from that. And then I did some research online, and I thought, right, well, if I add some other types of food, that perhaps I'd attract a greater range of birds. So I added some Niger seeds and some sunflower seeds. And eventually I spotted various birds coming in and out, and they had their own particular appetite. Like, for instance, the goldfinches would come in, and initially they'd eat from the Niger seeds. And as the weather got colder, I noticed them moving on to, say, the sunflower seeds. When the goldfinches come in, I just think it's like an all-you-can-eat buffet. So and then blue tits and members of the tits family would come in, and it's more like grab and go. So they take a peanut and scarper off as fast. So they were often quite difficult to capture, actually, because they're so fast and in and out, like almost like confetti.
You're absolutely right when it comes to the variety of different foods. The more different foods you put out, the more different species you'll attract in. Certainly 22 different species of birds so far this winter. That would be above average for a typical Irish garden. You've done very well there. We know from Birdwatch Ireland's annual Irish Garden Bird Survey that many gardens would struggle to get more than maybe 14 or 15. That would be very, very good. So 22, it's certainly very commendable. What would be your favourite of all of those, if you could pick one?
Well, I have two, actually, if you might indulge me. I really love the goldfinch. When I first saw the goldfinch, I can recall Patrick Kavanagh calling it a bird of paradise, and it sure is. It's really exotic, with that bright red face, that Zorro-like eye wear, and the black and white stripes on its head, and then the most glorious, almost canary yellow stripe in its wing, and black and white intertwined colours. Just absolutely stunning. But my second favourite now is one that I'd never known at all to this point, which is the blackcap. So in early January, I saw this little bird coming into the garden, silver grey back, almost sateen-like, and then this little brown cap on its head. And I'd never seen such a bird, and I did need a camera with a good lens to be able to focus in on that. So I discovered subsequently it was a female blackcap. And then some weeks later, I got two male blackcaps now in the garden and eating at the same time, usually seeds that fall off the feeder. But they're both my favourite birds. And like every time I see the goldfinch, it's just like a piece of exotica. It's just amazing. They're like really a bird of paradise.
Yeah, they're absolutely stunning creatures and doing very well in Ireland, I'm pleased to say. We're seeing the numbers increasing in gardens year on year, so that's a real success story. I think there can be a lot of doom and gloom around wildlife populations in Ireland. Well, we should focus on the successes too, and the goldfinch certainly is one, as is the blackcap. That's another species that has been increasing quite a lot in the winter. And of course, when you're attracting so many different species in and a big variety of different birds, as you mentioned, you will sometimes get birds like sparrowhawks coming in. Did the sparrowhawk actually catch any birds when you were watching it?
Well, I was funny. I was sitting at the kitchen window having coffee and a bird hit the window. And I initially I thought it was a pigeon because it just caught the corner of my eye. And for some reason, I instinctively went for the camera to take a shot. I don't know why, but I'm glad now I did because it was, as you said, a sparrowhawk flying in. I can understand the garden was literally littered with birds. They were all over the ground, feeding away, looking very happy. Tons of chaffinches, siskins, etc. And when I focused in closely on my photograph, I could see that the sparrowhawk caught a beautiful yellow siskin. But look, the feed was there for him, and that's what they have to do. That's nature.
Yes, indeed. That's exactly the way that nature works. And, you know, when we have feeders in our garden like that, we're bringing nature to us. So we see these predator-prey relationships play out in front of our eyes. So, you know, it can be difficult sometimes for people to watch, but it is part and parcel of nature, as you said. I always find it almost mind-blowing that, you know, perhaps blue tits that would nest in your garden might just have come from next door, but the black caps that are in your garden at the moment have probably come from Central Europe. You'll have other birds that have come maybe from Iceland, from Scandinavia. They're coming from all over to come to your garden, and coming and going. So over the next few weeks and months, you should start to see some migrants arriving in. Certainly something I would recommend, and I hope you continue to enjoy it. If you have any questions, of course, you know where to ask.
Thank you very much, Niall, because certainly it's been a fun journey of discovery for me.
And you can see the montage Gail made of the birds visiting her garden on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Let me get my papers in order. Now, the Natural History Museum, aka the Dead Zoo, is currently undergoing a long awaited refurbishment. The main planks, if you'll excuse the pun, of the work include major repairs to the leaking roof and reinforcing the floors. It's expected that the project will cost in excess of 15 million euro. The museum was built in 1856 and houses over 2 million items, which have to be dismantled and stored safely while the work is being done. When we last checked in, an expert crew was helping staff at the museum to remove two large whale skeletons, which were suspended from the ceiling. Work not for the faint-hearted, I'm sure you'll agree. Anyway, we're joined now by the National Museum Zoology Curator, Paolo Viscardi, from his home in Dublin. Hello, Paolo, how are you today? Tell us what's going on.
So at the moment in the Natural History Museum, we've been in the process of decanting the collections. So moving everything out of that first floor area and the kind of balcony levels. We need to replace the roof, and it's a huge amount of work to do that. And basically, we've been trying to get the collections out of the building so that that roof work can happen safely.
The top two floors have been closed for a long time. I mean, nobody has been able to go and see them for a number of years now. So when this is all completed and COVID allows, we'll be able to go and see all of the exhibits, not just the first two floors as before, but all the wonderful smaller things and the glass models, all of the things that were on the top two floors. Is that what I'm led to believe? They'll be available for everyone to see.
Well, that's what we hope. Now, that's going to be dependent on some funding. Really, this is a two-phase project. The first phase is we have to get a roof on the building because it's not watertight at the moment. So we've had loads of problems. The roof's at the end of its life. It's, you know, the building's 160 years old. Roofs don't get replaced that often because it's so disruptive. So this is the first full replacement of the roof that's happened in possibly 160 years. And then we see the next stage as being a great opportunity to hopefully, if all goes to plan, open up those top two balconies, make sure that everything is safe. Because at the moment, the floor loading on the balconies is low, and there are loads of issues, like the actual railing around the edge of that balcony is below my hip height. So anyone who's my height or above, and I'm average height, will just fall straight over that balcony if they're not careful. So it's not a very safe space, and because it's an old building, there are loads of issues with it. I think the Natural History Museum, the Dead Zoo, is the oldest museum that was actually built as a museum in Ireland. It'd be a real shame to lose that sense of history, that sense of continuity of that collection being in that space, because, you know, people have been going there for generations, and it's still very much like it was when, you know, great-grandfathers and great-grandmothers are bringing their kids. It hasn't changed much, and it's really nice to have that continuity, and we definitely see that the public enjoy that. So although in some ways it'd be great to have a new building which has, you know, did everything you needed, it would also be a terrible shame to lose the space that we do have.
Paolo, originally the entrance to the museum came from Leinster House. And if you, noticeable thing about it is, unlike museums anywhere, all the animals have their bottoms towards you. The normal protocol in museums is for every animal to face the door so that when you come in, you're faced with their expressions and so forth. Is there any remote possibility of going back to the original design and having an entrance that would come in from the Leinster House side? And are you going to turn things around if you don't do that?
Well, to be honest, I think it's unlikely that we're going to get an entrance from the Leinster House side, because other people are using that building, and I don't think they're willing to give it up just yet. I think the turning things around, we may well do that. That's something which we will be discussing, and there will be a whole series of decisions to be made about how we reinstall the space once we get to that stage. But right now, we're not thinking about that, because right now we're much more concerned about getting everything out of the building, which, quite frankly, is a mammoth undertaking of its own. We've taken down two whales, two full whale skeletons, a fin whale, you know, the second biggest animal on the planet. We've taken it apart and we've taken it out of the building. We've had to get the skull out through a window, which had to be removed. There's been all these sorts of quite big scale things, which, you know, have been pretty much at the forefront of our minds for the last few months.
Are you going to reorganise everything now? The first floor, which is international collection, you must be tempted to reorganise it and make it more modern, if you like. But I hope it will remain a cabinet museum, a museum of a 19th century museum, will it?
Yeah, we definitely intend to try to retain that same look and feel in the space. We don't really want to mess with what works. And we do find that our public and really, really do enjoy the building as it is. So at the moment, we're certainly not expecting to be doing kind of major redevelopments of the actual exhibition space. It would be nice to update some of the interpretation. There's a lot of things in there which are really out of date, and some of them kind of inappropriately out of date. So it'd be nice to address a few of those issues. You can't be going around referring to things like koalas as koala bears, because we know they're not bears. And the kind of old style labelling, which harks back, you know, 100 years ago, it's very colonial. And we do try to move away from that because, you know, it's not really an accurate representation of the world today. And so we don't want to be perpetuating that approach. But what we do want to do is to maintain that sense of history in terms of the collections that we have, the space that we have, and the importance of all of those objects in understanding the world around us.
Paolo, what I want to know is, where are you putting the stuff? If you had to take the window out to get the skull of the whale out, where did you put it? Where is all this stuff going?
We have a large off-site storage facility. So most of the materials going out there at the moment, probably about 9,000 objects in total by the time we finish this part of the move. I think we should be able to put everything into the spaces that we have available, but it will be a bit of a squeeze. The whale skull that we took out most recently, you know, it weighs half a ton. It's 4.5 metres long. It's not the easiest thing in the world to move. So it's a very involved process. So it's been fun.
When do you hope to welcome visitors back into the museum again?
At the moment, we're not able to go into the building to carry on decanting because of the restrictions. If we have another bout of restrictions, it's going to change the timescale on everything again. So it makes it very hard to plan timescale. So I don't want to say, oh, it'll be in, you know, July or August or something. I just don't know, because there are just so many unknowns out there. But if all goes to plan, we should be able to reopen again in the summer.
Well, let's hope so. And thanks for that update. Paolo Viscardi, thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, thanks so much, Derek.
More details on the website, as always, rte.ie/Mooney. Now, there's been a lot of talk in the media recently about boredom during lockdown. We've all heard, if not share the complaints, that we've exhausted the best of what Netflix and Amazon Prime has to offer. It got us thinking, and we wondered whether animals experience boredom. Our next guest is one of a small number of people who have actually researched this question. Biologist Dr. Charlotte Byrne is Associate Professor in Animal Welfare and Behaviour Science at the Royal Veterinary College in London, from where she joins us now. Hello, Charlotte. Tell us a little bit about your work, please.
In the last few years, I've been working on the idea of animal boredom, because so far that's mainly been studied by psychologists and using lots of questionnaires to ask humans questions, but it hasn't really been studied as a biological phenomenon before. And it's a really important animal welfare issue, And also just actually quite important for humans as well to understand why we get bored, why it causes the problems it does, and why it's so horrible for us. We need to know whether it's also horrible for animals. So
how would we know, looking at an animal, if it was bored or not? We can say to the animal, oh, are you bored today? You don't look as enthusiastic as you did yesterday.
That is a very good question, and the question that I and a few other colleagues have been trying to answer. And I think that there are three kind of behavioural hallmarks of boredom. Boredom is quite strange because it has two things about it that are quite contrasting. So the first thing is that when we're bored, there's obviously not enough stimulation to really keep us as awake as we would like. So we tend to do lots of things to try and seek stimulation and make ourselves feel interested, and animals might do the same thing. So you might see lots of kind of restlessness. They might try and escape their situation. They might try and seek out lots of new sort of stimuli. So investigate risky things and just do lots of unusual things to try and find something that actually engages them.
So Charlotte, you're saying then that the animals are bored because they have nothing to do, the same as humans when they have nothing to do. But surely this is a reflection on animals being in captivity. Animals in the wild surely are not bored. They're so busy escaping being eaten or looking for something to eat that they haven't time to be hanging around doing nothing. So we're to blame really then for animals being bored.
Yes, I'd agree with that. I think boredom would be a much more prolonged and inescapable situation for an animal in captivity. I mean, we do our best in most cases to try and give animals lots of things to do, but it can't really compare with the busyness and the meaningfulness and the variety of them living their own lives in the wild. But that said, obviously animals would have to have evolved the capacity to feel boredom, and that was long before captivity even existed. So I think for wild animals, it would be a much more brief and fleeting experience, and maybe just provide that kind of motivation to get them to start doing something new. It might mean that they start to explore something new. It might mean that they start to play. It might mean that they seek out some learning opportunities. And even in some animals, you might get an increase in boredom around adolescence, which might cause them to leave their safe natal home and their family group and actually go and seek a new territory of their own. It wouldn't last very long, perhaps, with a wild animal because it can do something about the boredom, and it would just therefore provide that kind of initial spark of kind of that horrible feeling of wanting something different that would actually make them go and do exactly what they need to do, take the risks and learn something new or go somewhere new.
Charlotte, boredom is a strange thing. We usually refer to it as an emotion, a feeling we have. We are bored. Dreary sermons long ago used to generate tremendous amounts of boredom. And people who do repetitive jobs are said to get very bored, and you get people singing while doing repetitive jobs to try and relieve that. Now, the question then is boredom an adaptive trait? Did evolution provide us with the mechanism to be bored, to prompt us to get on with it? Because we're not here for ourselves, we're here to pass our genes on to future generations and not to just hang around and waste resources. So is it a kind of adaptive prompt, you know? Is it volcanic, for instance? Does it build up in the person? I'm reminded of an elephant called Tyke, who went berserk in Honolulu at a circus and killed its trainer, and then went on a rampage through the town, killed another man, I believe, and was shot in a hail of bullets by the police. Now, it looked from the outside that this poor fellow was endured boredom for years, and it built up and it built up and it built up, and then he lashed out. Is boredom, therefore, a natural process with a function?
Yes, I think that the function of boredom would have been to provide that kind of spark and that motivation to get animals to do something new, to break free maybe from their kind of safe environment or what they already know, and start maybe taking risks and changing things to put them in a sort of new situation, help them learn new things, help them find new opportunities. So I think compared with an animal that didn't ever feel bored and would just stay in its particular situation and never change anything unless, you know, it was hungry, say, and needed to go and move itself to find food, I think the difference between that kind of animal that's maybe rather sedentary and an animal, maybe the first animal that evolved boredom, is that that animal that evolved boredom would be much more curious and it would go and seek new opportunities. It would go and learn more things. It would maybe be a more creative kind of animal.
Is it a function of an unnatural situation? If you take our situation now, we're very fragmented in modern society. We all have our own room and our own little world, our own desk at work and that kind of thing. If you visit someplace like Skara Brae, 5,000 years ago, the houses are all close together. People lived close. They knew the 50 or 100 people around them intimately. They were never alone, and presumably they were never bored. Is boredom a feature in animals as well as us of isolation, of being in solitary confinement or something like that? Is there a mechanism like that operating?
Yes, boredom often occurs when you almost don't know what you want, but you want something different from what's going on at the moment. Whereas loneliness, you do know what you want. You want your people or your animals around you. So it's much more specific sort of feeling, and it might dominate over boredom, but certainly boredom would be wrapped up in that if you're just isolated with nothing to do and no one to be with.
Now, animals in zoos, for instance, we condemn animals in, say, circuses, for instance. For instance, the performing animal is the one that's hit most. People think it's dreadful that lions are go in and jump on stands and things and get lumps of sugar from a trainer who cracks a circus whip at them, and this is terrible. Now, from the point of view of the lion, however, it would seem that keeping an animal like that in captivity, it would be much happier if it had to perform. The performance is a stimulus. It is a relief from boredom. And it is the animal that's kept in a cage and transported around the country to be exhibited to the public for money. That is the one to be condemned, not the performing animals so much. Or is this terrible heresy on my part?
I can see what you mean, and I think it all depends on whether the animal actually enjoys the performance or not and finds some kind of meaning in it. After all, the kind of sense of monotony that an animal would perceive is subjective. So if in its cage it's actually, yes, it's in there all the time, but it's where it wants to be and it's got lots of things that it likes in its cage and it finds ways to fill its time, that animal might not be bored. A performing animal might enjoy its routines and it might really be working to get the rewards. But then after a while, maybe it becomes really monotonous. So to us, it looks new and fun. But for the animal, it might become very meaningless. It might not be what it wants to do. It wants to do something, anything different from what it's doing. There's an interesting story some of your listeners might remember, a very famous African grey parrot called Alex, who was owned by a scientist called Irene Pepperberg. And Alex the parrot was incredibly clever and he learnt lots of words, which allowed us to realise that a parrot like him can understand lots of concepts such as colours and shapes and numbers and things. And Alex would do lots of training and he would do lots of demonstrations and get different sorts of rewards for being able to name all these different things and describe stuff. And I think for much of it, he enjoyed what he was doing, but there'd come a time when he'd had enough and he wanted to do something different. And Irene Pepperberg describes what he would do in this situation, and she says that he would stare at the ceiling, he would give ridiculous answers to the questions, he would start to ask for almost anything different from what he was doing. So he'd ask for water, but not drink it, he'd ask to go back in his cage, but want to come back out again, he'd ask for food and ask for objects. Those kinds of requests suggest that even though he was being kept cognitively stimulated and doing a task, he'd had enough and now wanted to do something different, and it really fits with the idea of him having become bored of what he was doing.
So he was throwing a tantrum, more or less. One question yes. I want to ask you about, zookeepers talk about enrichment. They make the animals sing for their supper, hang the meat up the tree so that the tiger has to climb up to get it, this kind of thing. The elephants hide the food from the elephant. Enrichment, presumably, you would recommend. Is it possible to enrich an artificial habitat successfully enough that is worthwhile doing?
I think it can be. It depends on the species and exactly what their environment's got in it. But we did some work on environmental enrichment recently and actually specifically tested whether it was successful in reducing signs of boredom in animals. Now, the first study was actually done by colleagues in Canada, and they were investigating this in fur-farmed mink. And they compared enriched and standard-housed mink, and they noticed that the barren-housed ones were lying awake, staring into space a lot. And so they wanted to know if they were bored, and they offered them a range of different things for them to investigate, and these ranged from nice things through to nasty things. And the very interesting thing was that the ones that were housed without environmental enrichment were significantly more likely to investigate those nasty things, which is really interesting because it suggests that the monotony is so awful that they would rather investigate something nasty than be stuck staring into space. So we followed up with a similar experiment with ferrets, and we found exactly the same thing. In our case, we actually let half the ferrets have some playtime outside their cage where they could explore a new area. And then we offered them different things. And we found that, again, the ones that had not had playtime came and investigated things that they didn't like. So they came and investigated things like peppermint smell and bitter apple smell, which made them gape and shake their heads. So they would do this and then they'd come back for more. Whereas the ones that had had playtime were not interested in that. They were only interested in coming and smelling nice things like mouse bedding. It's nice for them, but less nice for us. And then we looked at the ferrets back in their home cage as well. And we found that the ones that had not had any playtime were more likely to pick fights with each other. So they'd screech aggressively at each other. And they also did that lying awake and staring into space significantly more than the ones that had playtime the day before. So it really suggests that the enrichment was helping prevent those signs of boredom. And of course that the ferrets and the mink do sort of exhibit something like boredom as judged from their behaviour.
And a form of neurosis too, I imagine. Richard, do you remember the polar bear in Dublin Zoo? Whatever happened to it?
I do indeed. The poor polar bears, there was two of them. They were moved to Budapest Zoo, I think. They were in a very small company. They walked up and down, a sure sign of distress. So enrichment, Charlotte, is a kind of psychotherapy for neurotic animals. Neurosis derived from captivity and lack of stimulation. They have to break out and do dangerous things, like mountaineers who go up K2 because they're bored with life, even though their chances of coming back from K2 are pretty slim some of the time. But anyway, these are the thoughts that occur to me.
Yes, that's true. I think some environmental enrichment is really good for preventing boredom. But actually, a lot of those sort of repetitive behaviours that you were mentioning, like in the polar bear, they actually can derive more from very specific things that the animal is missing. So I would call that frustration, where, again, the animal knows what it wants rather than just wanting anything different from its current situation. So with the pacing polar bears, it seems to be linked to them almost their natural desire to patrol a large territory. Whereas if you've got grazers, their particular repetitive behaviours will often be things that they do with their mouths or their tongues. In their case, it would be maybe because of a lack of the natural feeding behaviours that they would do. So not specifically boredom related, but they need an enrichment that actually satisfies the particular need that is missing for them in captivity.
Now, so I remember this was very stressful. And there was an organisation called ZooCheck, and they would suggest various types of enrichment for animals caged in zoos. And I did a report for the BBC Natural History Programme on Radio 4 a long time ago, where they decided that they would pack all of the food in ice and that the bears would have to break through the ice to get to the food in order to make it a little bit more interesting for them rather than just throwing the meat in. But still, after it had done it, it would pace up and down.
Oh, yes. Yes, and so it's maybe satisfied a need to, I don't know, maybe do a little bit of something a bit like hunting behaviour, or at least sort of food handling behaviour, but it hasn't satisfied that need for to patrol the larger home range, perhaps.
Well, Charlotte, thank you very much indeed for talking with us today. No doubt you've stimulated some thoughts in our listeners they didn't know they were going to have until they heard you speak. So thanks again.
Thank you. It was really fun for me as well. And I enjoyed chatting with you.
And that's all we have time for today. My thanks to all of our contributors, to our regular panel of Dr. Richard Collins, Aidan Ilana and Niall Hatch, our researcher John Bella Riley, our broadcast coordinator Jarlath Holland, and today's producer Anna Leddy. Until next week, goodbye.
And Mooney Goes Wild was presented by Derek Mooney.